It is now my great pleasure and privilege to introduce to you tonight our speaker, Dr. Wayne Clark Roof. He is the, he's the J.F. Rowney Professor of Religion and Society and in the Department of Religious Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. He's also the director of the Walter H. Capps Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life at UCSB. He is very widely written. He's written over 16 books on the topics of religion and sociology. He's done many, many studies. He has a degree from... He has a BA from Wofford College, and a Master of Divinity from Yale, and an MA and PhD in Sociology from the University of North Carolina. In addition to all of his writings, he's been the researcher for many funded studies on the topic of religion in life, some in America, some in other countries. He... has also been given hundreds of interviews to television, radio, newspaper reporters, and he's had stories, cover stories from Time and Newsweek. And the reason he was selected as our featured speaker this evening is that our topic for this symposium is the spirituality of the rising generation. And he is a wonderful fit for that topic, and we look forward very much to hearing from him. He is married to Terry Roof, and she's going to be a panelist on one of our panels tomorrow on the topic of the Texas raids on the fundamentalist LDS ranch there, the Yearning for Zion Ranch. So we... invite you now to give a hearty welcome to Dr. Roof.
Thank you very much. That was a very gracious introduction. But half of what she said is true. The other half is just fluff. I'm going to be talking to you about generational thinking and religious identity. And I invite you to think along with me. We'll do this for about 40 or 45 minutes. Don't leave. 40 or 45 minutes. And I hope you hang in there with me until I finish. But if you should finish before I do, sit patiently, and hopefully I'll catch up with you just a few minutes later. Who am I? The ancient psalmist cried out. If we ask that question, we might answer it in so many different ways. A human being, an American, white, black, Samoan, Mormon, Roman Catholic, Methodist, and on and on. Probably it has not occurred to you to think of yourself as a part of a generation, a pre-boomer, a boomer, a Generation Xer, a member of the millennial generation. And yet, conscious or not of this aspect of our identity, that is, the generational aspect of our identity, generation is far more important, I think, than we generally realize. Perhaps we are most aware of our generational identity when we hear a popular song, or choose clothes with particular labels, or watch a television show. Then we resonate in varying ways with the experience. Either it connects with us, and it becomes who we are it, or just the opposite, it is not who we are. It belongs to somebody else, older than us, or probably younger than us. Research demonstrates that Americans of all ages, when asked about the important social influences on their lives, recall as especially important those memories referring to a time when they were about 10 to 16 years old. Very impressionable years, as we all know. The influences during these years are lasting, and that's what makes generational identity so important. They're often subtle, but deeply imprinted. Events and experiences remain with us, indeed become part of us. Global and national crises, family experiences, the impact of the media and politics, even our experiences of the sacred. To say this somewhat differently, we see the world around us and that which we believe in through a set of lens shaped in great part by our early experiences. Thus, the Depression generation of the 1930s and 1940s was sensitive to the perils of a precarious economy and developed a deep sense of the possibility of material loss. The Vietnam generations, the baby boomers of the 1960s and 1970s, became, and still is, that generation still is, very wary of war, ambivalent, and somewhat distrustful of institutions. Generation Xers, born later in the 1970s and 1980s, in the shadow of the large baby boom generation, feel that not much attention has been given to them and cry out for a bit more attention often, particularly so in their music, which reaches out for friendship and finding trust. Young Americans of the millennial generation, teenagers and those now approaching adulthood or in their early adulthood, who witness the horrible destruction and loss of life in New York City and Washington on September 9, 2001, in their impressionable years, they will carry with them, no doubt, throughout their lives, feelings of unease and insecurity brought on by acts of global terrorism. Think of these differing things I've said about these generations as frames of interpretation. All these people are Americans, yet they've experienced a very different America. They've had their visions, hopes, and dreams shaped accordingly to their experiences. Also note several things about these several generations and their experiences. The first is the importance of deep psychological realities, emotions, and feelings. Something deep within them was touched, and in a lasting way, more than anything we can call rational. We carry with us perceptions and feelings framed early in our lives that guide us in our responses. All of us are Americans, having so much in common, yet seeing the world in such different ways. Each of us, certainly each generation, constructs a worldview, a way of looking at reality, a way of defining reality, a way of looking at how the world hangs together. The poet Wallace Stevens, I think, was onto something when he says, "We live in the description of a place, not in the place itself." I'm not sure I totally agree, but I agree in great part. Important too, generational change is far more frequent today than in the past. As the pace of modern social change has increased, so too have our differing experiences of life. Most obvious, perhaps, with fashions, music, and popular culture. Because we live in a highly materialistic, consumption-oriented culture, so much of life, and particularly the differences in our lives, are defined by material goods, clothes, cars, music, television programs, iPods, Blackberries, and on and on and on. All designed to appeal to one another age group, and thus they themselves become markers of generations. But also true is the fact that every generation, old, young, whatever, carries on a conversation with the past. We are never totally new. We carry on a conversation with those who have gone before us. That's what tradition is all about. A way of thinking, believing, acting that's been passed down to us. So no matter how different a new generation's experience with our fast-paced world, much of how any generation understands itself is by comparing itself with those who came before. We are who we are in part because of who we are not. I know myself over against my grandparents and parents, and in comparison with my children, and increasingly with my grandchildren. Identities are complex and forged in the presence of others. Historian Amanda Porterfield writes that, quote, legacies established by earlier generations persist in the lives and ideas of new generations, underpinning and reframing everything new, while at the same time, new generations of interpreters constantly create fresh images of the past. We can't get away from the past. As the great Southern writer William Faulkner once said, the past, why, it's not even past. Yet equally true, how we think of the past and understand our relations to the past is itself a matter of selective construction, and thus new in its own way. Now let's make sure we heard that. How we think of the past and of ourselves in relation to the past is a selective construction, and thus new in its own way. To put it differently, we live with worldviews, belief systems, values, even conceptions of religious faith, all of which are selectively created in keeping with the social world in which we live. Symbolic realism is a phrase coined by the sociologist Robert Bellah for describing why, for example, two people can look at the American flag and one interpret it as a symbol of the opportunity that every individual has to pursue his or her own dreams, and the other can interpret it as a symbol of a nation that honors the equality of all people, no matter their race, class, color, or creed. Symbols, even religious symbols, have no single meaning. But isn't religion more eternal, you ask? Something that is stable in the midst of the unstable, unchanging amidst that which is changing? Well, yes, in one meaning of that word, that is true. However, as human beings, we have our limitations. Limitations because none of us can grasp the fullness of truth or the full meaning of transcendence in life. As Oscar Wilde once said, the truth is rarely pure and never simple. But for that reason, there are opportunities, human opportunities. In our experiences, there are glimpses of the transcendence and its meaning that are distinctive to us in our particular time and place. The point is, the experience of the sacred, or if you prefer, the experience of God, these experiences are rich and unlimited and cannot be contained by the experience of any one person or by the experiences of any one tradition or institution in the name of religion. If we think otherwise, then we create God in our own image, and our God becomes too small, as C.S. Lewis once said. And when that happens, we become captive to our own symbolic world, as if it is the only world. And then the next step is to begin drawing lines between us and them. How easy it is in all religious traditions to overlook those prophetic injunctions that warn us of the particular and call us to the universal. For example, there is that injunction in the Quran which reports Allah as saying, quote, if we had wished, we could have made you one people, But as it is, we have made you many. Therefore, vie among yourselves in good works. End of quote. In other words, do good deeds was the teaching out of the Quran. Why? Because in showing respect to others who are very, very different, that in effect illustrates the extent to which any one of us or any one tradition knows about the transcendent. That there's more to transcendence than any one person, group, or tradition can claim. Of course, in many important ways, we are being stretched today to think outside the box, to expand our views, to be more self-aware of both our limitations of perspective and the opportunities that come with those limitations. For one thing, we're more aware of religious diversity today in our nation and certainly in our world than probably ever before. All the world's religions are in the United States today, right here even in Utah. And Christianity, to which we are related to, or a form of, is no longer predominantly limited to North America. The majority of Christians today live outside Europe and outside North America. Religious diversity, the rapidity of change, is so much a part of our consciousness, and the growth and spread of religions in our very midst. And then secondly, there's generational consciousness, our topic tonight, which is helping us to understand the diversity of religious experience. Because the generations come and go so rapidly in our time, we're more aware of how frames of religious meaning and experience differ over time, depending upon people's own experiences, spaced as we are between those who have gone before us and those following us. And of course, it is the younger generations, and particularly the millennial generation and the Generation Xers, who have and will have had the greatest encounters with religious diversity. So diversity of faith traditions and diversity of generations are coming together in creating some powerful, powerful changes. I want to suggest that all of us, and especially young people today, are caught up in some major shifts of consciousness. And I'm going to be referring to some of those. We might say that, in terms of exposure to diversity, that pre-boomers, I won't date those folks, pre-boomers, but the boom generation begins in 1946, birth year 1946, so you can figure this out. Pre-boomers had far less exposure to diversity and still in many ways are challenged by the notion of religious diversity. Baby boomers, beginning birth year 46 to 1964, were truly challenged by diversity of lifestyles and religions and in many other ways. The young millennial generation today basically takes diversity for granted. Notice the change over those three generations. Great challenges, frustrations with, taken for granted. Part of it, too, is a shift in identity consciousness. If you were born in the 1950s or before, you were inclined to regard your identity as something you were born with. If you grew up in the 1980s and 1990s, you were more likely to regard your identity as something you created. There's a big difference. Self-conscious awareness of the world in which you're in and the opportunities for you to define that world in ways that are meaningful to you. So, I have about three big points about these shifts in consciousness. First, there's a reclaiming of the spiritual going on in our culture today. By that I mean a turning inward, a search for inner meaning and feelings, for self-authenticity. 100 years ago, the great psychologist William James distinguished between first-hand religion and second-hand religion. First-hand religion he defined as personal and experiential, that which resonates within the life and experience of a person. Second-hand religion refers to the creeds, doctrines, traditions, customs, and institutions that are built up around religious experiences and interpretations. Today we hear a lot about first-hand religion, even though no one really calls it that. That was William James's term. The fashionable word is spirituality. For most Americans, the spiritual and the religious overlap. That is, in religious belief and practice, people sustain an inner spirituality. But there are restless souls who seek more than what existing institutions offer. And some, of course, break out of those institutions altogether and look inward for their own truth and wisdom. When someone, for example, says, "I'm spiritual, but not religious." There are several types of spiritual seekers on the scene. There's the mystical seeker, the person who, for whatever reason, is dissatisfied with or feels constrained by a particular religious institution or tradition, and thus explores new teachings and practices. Many baby boomers are mystical seekers. They grew up questing for new truth, new experiences. Many continue to do that. Many were unfilled by the dreams of materialistic success and the endless consumption of goods that our culture encourages upon us. Many still seek instead an inward sense of calmness, flow, mindfulness, and stillness, so hard to come by in contemporary society. If these words suggest a retreat of sorts from the churches, or from the rat race of our mainstream culture, and not infrequently the religious institutions representing that mainstream culture, that is exactly what it is. There is a restlessness on their part with religion, any religion, that fails to feed the soul in all its deepest longings. There are as well the wounded seekers, those who feel that they have been harmed physically or psychologically in a religious community. This woundedness may stem from the overzealous efforts of well-meaning yet overly demanding religious leaders or family members or spouses who wittingly or unwittingly create guilt and suffering on those who doubt, question, or rebel. Wounded seekers call into question the practices of religious organizations and traditions that injured them or fail to give them voice. This pain is felt by some segments of our society more so than others, of course. Women, historically, and in our day especially, by gays and lesbians. And there are also justice seekers. People who seldom identify themselves using exactly those words, but if you probe them carefully, you discover what their motivation is. Their motivation is to try to bring about greater social justice. Issues of poverty, age, racism, human rights, the environment, injustice in many forms are their concerns. They call into question religion that focuses totally on comfort, happiness, and prosperity at the exclusion of social obligations. They are critics of established religious communities that serve the interests of the status quo while overlooking the powerless and those in need. They stress that personal faith, important as it is not enough, and that spirituality should reach outward and address the social structures that create and maintain injustices. Now, I should like to make clear that LDS members, compared with members of other faith communities in the United States, show fewer signs of this seeker mentality. Of the three types of seeker mentality I just mentioned, LDS members show fewer signs of any of that kind of spiritual seeking in our culture today. Polls and surveys show that Mormons register higher levels of commitment to their traditional religious institutions than to other religious communities. The Mormon world is more self-contained than that of other religious worlds, which to be sure has virtue, so long as its boundaries do not stifle creativity or woman. At the same time, we should not assume Mormons to be overly isolated from the larger spiritual trends of American culture. And it's a seductive temptation to think that's the case. Institutional religious boundaries in a free and voluntary society like ours are porous. And particularly when you think about the huge influence of television and popular culture upon us all. This latter's influence is apparent in a recent and excellent study of American teens by the sociologist Christian Smith. He finds that 2/3 of Mormons in his study, more so than for any other religious group, believe that only one religion, their religion, is true. Not surprising, really. Yet 23%, mostly young Mormons, say many religions are true. 31% of Mormon teens in this survey of just 4 years ago say it is okay to pick and choose religious beliefs without having to accept teachings of faith as a whole. It's almost a third of Mormons, 31%. When asked if they consider themselves as spiritual but not religious, 46% of Mormon teens responded saying, very true or somewhat true. And here's a statistic that might surprise you. 26% of Mormon youth say they definitely are leaning toward believing in reincarnation. Those figures are higher outside the Mormon traditions. In some instances, considerably higher, upwards of 40-50%. So what do we make of such statistics? You can read these figures as demonstrating either the continuing strength of Mormon institutions in holding on to their young and how they believe, or as evidence of a weakening capacity to contain them with their own religious world. I leave the interpretation up to you, either of those. A second shift in consciousness has to do with how we image or picture God. Slowly and gradually, there are some important changes away from traditional conceptions. But again, I should note that Mormons continue to hold on to more traditional pictures of God far more so than most mainstream religious groups in the United States. Let's begin with the Pew Survey, the largest survey on religion ever carried out on American religion, with 34,500 people interviewed 3 years ago. Their findings were just released several months ago, and you may have heard about those findings. They found that 92% of people say they believe in God. That's really nothing new. Americans are really prone to believe in God, unlike people in many other countries. I've been at this for quite a while, I've never seen a survey that has less than 90% of Americans say they believe in God. But what is startling is the second question. Can you describe the God? There we get far more diversity today than was true 10 years ago, not to speak of 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. What we find is that there's a shift, particularly from authoritative pictures of deity to more comforting and sustaining and nurturing images of deity. That's one of the major shifts. So there's definitely a shift toward what Andrew Green calls warm pictures of God rather than rather cold pictures. Interestingly, agnosticism is very much on the increase. Atheism is not. We're not a country where atheism is very popular. But agnosticism is popular. By which I mean having an open stance toward belief and being curious but not quite capable of committing to a particular belief about God. The evidence suggests that is quite considerable in contemporary society. What is interesting about the religious scene today is the curiosity that so many people have about religion. The fascination surrounding belief, even among those who aren't sure what they really believe. It may be that the hold of faith upon many people has declined, even though these same people, and perhaps a growing number of people, easily talk about God and engage in religious and spiritual questions, even if they don't believe. This appears to be something of a paradox, and possibly a sign that we aren't as religious as all our rhetoric would suggest. Whether our religion is deep or shallow, clearly it is very much in the news today. And this is one of the interesting things about American religion. American religion has become so identified with virtually all the issues of life. It has always been identified with issues, of course, but what's interesting is the great range of issues which religions identify with today. We cannot have a conversation about politics in this country, about morality, about family, about lifestyles, science, or global conflicts without religious issues taking center stage. And that's fascinating, I think. It suggests that a lot of people are trying to think through the meaning and interpretation of faith as it relates to this wide range of issues. As commentator Winifred Gallagher says, Americans today are, quote, working on God, by which she means people are looking to find greater direction in their lives by aligning their sense of self with a notion of deity who is supportive of their concerns. Now, that's rather the benign interpretation of some of these trends. There are others, including some sociologists of religion, who are quite worried about these trends. For example, Christian Smith, a sociologist I just mentioned, whose data I've been associating or sharing with you, he recently did this study of teen Americans, and he says the traditional conception of God seems to be almost lost among teen Americans, by and large. Again, Mormons less so than for the population as a whole. I'll come back to that. But he says the new conception of God among teen Americans, he describes as moralistic therapeutic deism, by which he means the following four or five things. First, God creates the world. These are all very simple notions, but in his view, it's all become rather simplified in that teenage mind. God created the world. God wants to be second. God wants to be good, nice, and fair. Good, nice, and fair. Three, the central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good. Anybody recognizing a teenager? Fourth, God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when God is needed to solve a problem. And fifth, good people go to heaven. Now, in a nutshell, there is Christian Smith's description of what he finds pervasive in teenage American culture. Note the mix of elements. It's rather moralistic, one ought to be good. All religions are just about equal, true, about the same. God should be called upon mostly for comfort and happiness. And all of this, if dealt with properly, should lead to heaven. Now, I think what we've got here is a fascinating kind of development among young, very young Americans, which suggests, if you will, kind of a product of this reality of diversity that I've been talking about. Teenage Americans take for granted diversity, religious diversity, as well as many other kinds of diversity, including lifestyle diversity. So in the kind of homogenized culture that's emerging, particularly through the media, we've got an emerging kind of image of God as in the ways that I've just described, and of the religious life in the ways that I've just described. So one concern might be here is that the peculiarities of faith traditions may be challenged in this emerging young, very young youth culture. Again, I'm not here to make judgment about advantages or disadvantages, the good or bad aspects of trends. My job, I leave that to the theologians. My job as sociologist is to try to describe what I think is going on. And clearly this is one very interesting bit of information about what our millennial teenagers are thinking and believing. And then finally, our third leg, there's this bigger question, this shift of consciousness, which has to do with, and is a big word here, truth. Truth. Hardly an easy topic to deal with as a speaker, and in our culture today, we live in a relativist thinking world where we believe we shouldn't offend people about their views. As long as someone doesn't hurt you, harm you, they're entitled to think, believe, act pretty much as they choose. Choice is a big word of our culture. Choice, freedom. The big word for philosophers is epistemology. How do you know that which is true? And that's an interesting question for the millennial generation, so exposed to religious and moralist diversity. How do you know that which is true or right? We all know that in the modern or postmodern world, depending on how you want to describe the scene in which we live, traditional religious authority has lost some of its power. Increasingly, people want to weigh in on matters that pertain to them. It comes with the times. Tradition suffers in the postmodern world. Our culture privileges that which is new, the latest, and the best. Consumer capitalism has an insatiable hunger for the sale and resale of marketable stuff. It shapes a mentality more open to the new than to honoring and preserving the old. Authority in all of that suffers greatly. Not just religious authority, but so too have many other forms of authority been diminished in the world in which we live. Just think of what happens with physicians. How many people want a second opinion or a third opinion? How many people go to the internet, read as much as they can about an illness, then argue with their doctor? What do you mean? I read this. So in effect, I think that's emblematic of the world in which we live when we talk about authority. People are suspicious of a singular source of authority. Even in the Roman Catholic confessional, there's something significant going on. Historically, the confessional was established for a person to confess his, her feelings to God through the priest and to be absolved by the priest. That was definitely a vertical arrangement of authority, God, priest, believer. Now research suggests that many people do not feel the need to go through, many Roman Catholics do not feel the need to go through the priest to get to God. And then the second point about this I want to make is that I noticed last year when I was on a sabbatical and visiting in Paris, nice break from what I was normally doing, I spent a lot of time at the Notre Dame Cathedral. And one of the things that really fascinated me, and I'd been there 10 years ago and hadn't noticed this, because this, what I'm going to tell you, wasn't was there at the time, they've changed the signs over the confessionals in the Notre Dame Cathedral sometime in the past 10 years, between the times I was there. It used to say confession. Now it says confession / dialogue. I'm not here to confess, dear priest. I'm curious. We can talk about it. I might expose a little bit of myself. Maybe even something we used to call sin. But can we just talk about it? Help me find a way through this. So what is emerging is some kind of new style of what I would call horizontal authority, not the vertical part. Horizontal authority. One involving shared views, interpretation, dialogue. You might say there's a kind of democratization of authority going on. We want to have our voice in there, not be told necessarily. We see this trend religiously and spiritually in a great variety of ways. For example, 12-step groups, many small groups within religious congregations. The importance in our day of people telling their own stories. We love to hear stories. We love to tell stories. The growth of spiritual retreat centers. The fact that businesses and corporations all discover spirituality and now often hold seminars for their employees on the work and spiritual meaning of work. And the attraction of television programs like Oprah and Dr. Phil. Public confessionals of sorts, where people can talk about their life situations, their challenges, their problems. In effect, people appear to be looking for the wisdom that arises out of shared experiences. And just pointing this out, it seems to me a kind of significant shift that's going on in the culture that has important consequences for religious authority. Religious authority is undergoing some significant changes in and of itself. Historically, we have been a print culture. Authority resting in text. You read. You can debate. You can interpret sacred texts as well as other texts. But we're living increasingly in a culture of image. Seeing is believing, less so than hearing in the traditional sense. Seeing is believing. The baby boom generation was the first generation to grow up with television. Huge impact. They were followed by Generation Xers who were the first to grow up on the internet. Huge again. And now the millennials are growing up on text messaging, iPods, Blackberries, and all the new communication gadgets that I cannot keep up with. With sounds and images evolving as fast as we can talk. Sounds and images. Reshaping our sense of how the mind works, especially as it deals with information. And we're cluttered with information. We have so much information and so little wisdom. Yeah? Just try to get an answer to a medical problem. So much information. My doctor about 10 years ago told me I had a problem with gout. Told me to get off of strawberries. Bad for gout. I didn't eat strawberries for 2 or 3 years. I love strawberries. Didn't eat strawberries. Gave it up. Go see my doctor. He says, you know what I told you about strawberries? Forget it. New studies show it makes no difference. That's our world today. It's a new definition, faster than we all sometimes live, it seems, of reality. There's so many competing authorities. The influence of the media, especially for young Americans. And all the self-appointed gurus who dispense so-called wisdom combined with psychology and practical advice. Moreover, there's an explosion of new organizations and movements mixing elements of religion, spirituality, and psychology that baffle even professional religious scholars today. Quote, ride down the back roads of Pennsylvania or Ohio or Oregon for 2 hours, writes historian Lawrence Moore, and you can bring back a list of signboard announcements that will baffle any panel of experts. Just who are the Jews for Jesus sinners? Who runs the Faith for Today chapel at the entrance of the trailer park? What tradition are we to make out of science welcoming questers after religious insight counseling? End of quote. And finally, we're left, I think, with a huge, and this is really finally, huge question of back to diversity and authority and truth. It all kind of comes together. What are we to do with the reality of religious pluralism? We can stick our heads in the sand and say, well, we have the truth. And all others are simply wrong. But on second thought, if there is a second thought, it is difficult to defend such a position. Genuine pluralism rests upon more than just tolerance. It calls for respect and appreciation for the other. Tolerance is a relatively weak word. What we need, as Diana Eck says, is positive pluralism, engagement, learning from the other, appreciating the other, defining oneself over against the other, and in ways in which there's a common heritage and in ways in which we have our particularity. Perhaps most important of all, pluralism is a way of life that has to be cultivated and practiced. And it begins, of course, with our neighbors of a different faith next door. It does not require that we abandon our own distinctive traditions or become lax in our own convictions. We live in our particularity, and indeed we are nourished in our particularity. T.S. Eliot wrote, quote, no man has ever climbed to the highest stages of the spiritual life who has not been a believer in a particular religion or at least a particular philosophy. Respect for the other faith, as I've said, can and should arise out of the depths of both our human limitations and our opportunities. This is really the challenge for our time, isn't it? How to respect in a deep way the religious other in such a way that our own particular faith, spirituality, quest for meaning is itself enriched, without itself watering down whatever we believe in ourselves. Bill Moyers, in his latest book, quotes the spiritual writer Kathleen Norris, who sums up in her own pointed way the challenges of pluralism for our time. She writes, chosenness, in one sense, is a thing of the past. We are all God's chosen now. And immediately following that sentence, she offers a prayer. God help us because we are. Thank you very much. I appreciate your patience.
We now have time for some questions. And for those of you who would like to ask a question, I would request that you either come up here to the microphone or use the microphone that Mary Ellen is setting up here in the aisle. And while you're thinking about questions, I'll ask one.
Okay.
You noted in your statistics that Mormons hang on to their traditional beliefs more than other faiths.
According to this survey.
I would suggest that one thing that survey doesn't take into consideration is that there are probably millions of Mormons who are on the, who are counted among the 13 million Mormons who no longer consider themselves Mormon. And so those people have moved outside of the Mormon tradition already. But even among those staying within the tradition, to have a third of the people have some significant beliefs that are maybe not the beliefs in a one and only true church, mm-hmm. is a significant number. Mm-hmm. And what I'm wondering is, how does an authoritarian structured church like the LDS Church, that has a hierarchy, that has all of the answers, relate to especially young people who are moving away from those authoritarian answers? How does it keep those young people? And there was a statistic that came out last after our last general conference, where a new young women's for the young women's organization was doing a press conference, and they asked what they were going to do to keep the 80% of young women who were leaving between the young women's organization and the women's organization in the Relief Society. And she didn't challenge that statistic. She said that's priority number one. So I'm just wondering if there's a pretty large group of young women, young men even in the church, whose beliefs are now apparently, or practices or something, are not consonant with the church enough to keep them interested in it. What do churches in that position need to do?
Thank you. Now, if I had the answer to this question, I would be writing that book and trying to sell it in the mass market. It's a very good question. First, your observation is intriguing about there are all those people out there who may not identify as Mormon in this instance. And I think that's true. You know, in these surveys, you go by self-definition. So they're asked, you know, what is your religious faith, if any? And somebody says, well, I'm whatever, I'm a Quaker, Methodist, Presbyterian, whatever. So we're totally dependent upon those self-definitions. But at the same time, we know, and don't misunderstand when I say this, but people lie a lot about religion. Especially about how frequently they go to church. And we've done some experimental studies where we've observed people who didn't, who said they were, went, but they didn't go. And we've got to get them on pictures. We know there's a, you know, an inconsistency between what people do and what there's a system in what they ought to do. So there's all kinds of problems with the data here, and any sociologist of religion knows that's true. So that complicates the picture to begin with. But the larger question is, as I understand it, what can a faith tradition do to reach out to these so-called new agnostics and people who are more engaging and trying to question and to some extent doubting, but seeking in their own way to clarify? I think religious institutions need to recognize the reality of that. Now, that's hard to do in a faith tradition like LDS, where you've got a historic patriarchal structure, authority vested in the hands of a relatively small number of people. That's a challenge. But to the extent to which, I mean, it seems to me the way in which you try to accommodate that is to create opportunities for forums, listening, opportunities for people to give feedback, and open up new venues for shared authority. How to do that? I don't know, but I am saying that would be ways of connecting with the kind of mentality that I think is characterizing many of our younger people today. And sociologists are not good about predicting the future. Usually we're wrong when we make predictions. But one might predict that as this millennial generation matures, the question is, what's going to happen? Will there be a greater number of dropouts or people that you've already alluded to no longer identify as Mormon, perhaps? Or, who knows, as marriages and parenting phases come on, that's often when people go back to their religious traditions after a period of less engagement. You know, if that could happen too, especially given my larger thesis that a generational change comes and goes and is relatively frequent. So what is the post-millennials, and they don't have a name yet, these are people recently born, you know, they're little kids, elementary school. What if there's some kind of religious revival that comes along? So we can't even predict that at this point, but we know that change is not like one decline with religion. Religious change is more like swings up and down. So given that, I'm not prepared to predict what's going to happen with the very, very youngest people we might be talking about today. I'm just reporting to you on what seems to be the millennial pattern at this particular phase in their lives, particularly the upper teenagers. I don't know if that answers your question. I've learned how to talk about things without giving an answer.
I have a couple of questions. The first one is, youth today, do they believe in Satan? Do they believe that the devil exists? And from your surveys?
They're not exactly my surveys, but generally, yes. That hasn't totally disappeared. I think most surveys would show that the number not believing in Satan or the devil has increased in the past 20 years or so, but it's still relatively high. Mm-hmm. Relatively high.
Because I was thinking that possibly the youth of today, embracing warmer, more comforting symbols. Mm-hmm. Relativism, mm-hmm. that maybe being good mm-hmm. is important, mm-hmm. but they don't really consider the opposite side. Adults, or I want to be careful how I say this, and I may say it wrong, but evil exists in the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if youth are keyed into that. I know that from my readings, basically they believe that environmentalism is sort of a new religion, and that there is a real need to be respectful of the earth and its resources and be a steward to it. In fact, the Pope himself has embraced that. And I'm wondering where the Ten Commandments come in, where maybe traditional standards and boundaries, and if that has a meaning, or if they feel like that doesn't matter as much. Mm-hmm. And that they... So we'll start there. Thank you.
You brought quite a lot there with your questions. One thing is a reality today. It's called religious illiteracy. People don't know a lot about religion.
Is that new?
By and large. It's not new, but it seems to have gotten worse. Religious illiteracy. I think the number of people that know more than three of the Ten Commandments, as can name them in a way that's recognizable with the text. The number that can name three or more is appalling in terms of our sheer literacy, whether you believe it or not, just the sheer knowledge. I read a survey of college students where 7% of people apparently believe that Joan of Arc is Noah's wife. state, 7%. The point is, there's a lot of illiteracy, and certainly it's not new, but it makes it difficult, I think, you know, for people to reflect upon their own religious tradition if you don't have some basic sense of things. Now, with respect to your question about boundaries, you know, it's built into the human condition to draw boundaries. I mean, that's just the way life is. So it's you, it's me, there are boundaries, there's male, there's female, there's all kinds of mechanisms of boundary making, and that doesn't go away. The question is, to what extent does religious identity itself as a boundary operate? That one person would say, I'm a religious person, I have faith, I'm committed, over against their opposites. And again, I think it might be easy to exaggerate the change, and I don't want to do that. People have always been able to differentiate religious and non-religious. The material that I cited to you about teenagers was not a loss of boundary. It was a change in the content of the religious, that it was less focused around a particular faith tradition and more about what we all share. No matter what our background tradition, we believe that good is better than bad. We believe there is a God, but we can't describe the God too well. We believe that we need a God to comfort us. We prefer a God that comforts us rather than gives us commandments. Again, I don't want to overstate that. That's from one study, just one study, but it certainly resonates with my sense of teenagers today, the findings of that particular study. I hope this gets at some of your questions.
Hugo.
We have a situation in the church now. Recently, the leaders of the church sent a letter to California regarding Proposition 8, telling members to do all they can to help pass Proposition 8, which would ban same-sex couples from the possibility of getting married. And what I was thinking while you were talking was that probably there's a lot of Generation Xers who are Mormons, who went to college, who interacted with gay and lesbian people there, and who do not believe that gay and lesbian couples are a threat to the family. So how do you use your generational framework to analyze the situation that we have?
Well, you're actually right. It's the younger generations that are far more open on an issue of that kind. It seems to me that Generation Xers and the millennial generation coming along now, the surveys suggest that these folks pretty much take that kind of lifestyle diversity almost for granted. So it's just there. It's a part of everyday perception of reality. Now, it's Americans that are older than those two generations that I think are more distraught over that particular issue. Now, I'm generalizing, of course, about both older Americans and about younger Americans, but at least the poll data suggests that the big divide is between somewhere in the boom generation, between those who are older and those that are younger than the boomers. So I think it's always interesting to look at what seems to be taken for granted by any particular group, and diversity of that kind is increasingly taken for granted among younger Americans. It's highly politicized and therefore made very visible and controversial, as we all know. But it's one of the big cleavages in our culture today. It's the basis of the so-called culture war. Those who approve or don't approve or whatever. So, and underlying much of that is a perceived threat to the family. There's no question that that is there too. And you can understand why that would be true, in the sense that family can be thought of as a kind of experiment of society. Family is a basic unit of the society. family structure is the basis of order and some degree of civility. And if family structures change, there's certainly a fear on the part of many that that suggests a breakdown of society more broadly. So I think the fear that arises comes out of that mindset. But what I would say is that people need to look carefully at the studies of people, gay, lesbian, and whatever other categories you would introduce, and look carefully at the empirical evidence in terms of their contributions of those groups, rather than the fears surrounding them. So, it's not my job to give you an answer about the rightness or wrongness. I'm just trying to describe to you the logic that goes on with our thinking.
A question. You talked about the increasing diversity of our American culture and the fact that all the world's religions are here. Does anything in your study suggest the influence of, you know, you mentioned Christianity being greater outside the United States now than in, the extent to which those other cultures are having an influence on the very seminal questions, the core questions that you ask. For example, it seemed to me that one anticipates that there might be the kind of shift in Anglicanism that has happened in Anglicanism because of the developing world and the more conservative pull there. Are there situations in which there is a more liberal influence from those cultures? And do you have any personal opinion about a religion that sends so many people out into the world, as the latter states do, to come in contact with other cultures, and whether any of that is coming back to have, you have probably more languages spoken here in the Salt Lake Valley than maybe any place in the United States, at least among really fluent speakers, people who have lived abroad and been in touch with other religions. Would you anticipate that would have a more liberalizing influence on a culture, or perhaps the opposite?
I'm not sure how I didn't get any hard questions today. I would listen carefully to anyone who had a definitive answer for that question. You know, empirically, as we know, the extent of diversity has greatly increased and continues to increase. And you made reference to the valley here. I don't know what that looks like in particular, but I know that in Los Angeles, the public school system teaches roughly 120 different languages geared to global diversity. So that's big. That's diversity. Now, there's a difference between diversity and pluralism. Diversity is a demographic reality. We got so many of this, so many of that. This is the mix of people out there. Pluralism is an ideological concept. That has to do with the quality of the interaction between them. How well do they get along? Are they living in conflict or modes of acceptance? Do they respect one another, etc.? So, what happens when strange peoples with strange religions, strange cultures, customs, what happens when they come together in one place? That's the question I think you're asking. Well, there's no one answer. You knew I would say something like that. Social interaction among groups is such that it can take many turns, depending upon circumstances, depending upon incidents that happen. You know, if there's an incident that happens with respect to conflict between racial or ethnic groups, and suddenly have violence, that can change the whole course of interaction among groups, and it can go downhill. And when you thought you were going, things were getting better, they can suddenly get much worse. So that is always a possibility when we're dealing with anything like culture, and particularly religious culture. Why? Well, I think the explanation is obvious. Religious culture brings God into the picture. If you can say, God approves, God is on the side of this religious group over against that religious group. What other legitimation do you need other than divine legitimation? So that just intensifies the potential for conflict. So then it becomes incumbent upon us, and now I speak in a more normative frame, it becomes incumbent upon us to try to cultivate and practice what I was describing as pluralism. Because it's a fragile world out there. The interaction among groups is very fragile. It can go in so many directions. So in a global age, and as we see so much evidence in our world today, where the potentiality of conflict is so great, and the potential for real serious human destruction in a post 9/11 world, I think and this is why I get so much attention in my lecture, it's incumbent upon us to try to create a world in which we can figure out how to get along. And it doesn't, as I said, it doesn't mean we give up anything of our own belief, faith, tradition. But it does say something to us about accepting the other. One thing I haven't mentioned tonight, which is affecting much of what those millennial generation patterns look like, is the degree of interfaith marriage in today's culture. Just like what happens with interfaith marriage. Now, there are kids out there that need a computer package to figure out their family history because of so many differences in family ancestry. And I guess that's a topic that Mormons would have a lot of interest in, family ancestry. But I don't really know how to answer your question. Most days I am an optimist, but there are those days that I'm not. Probably my wife would agree. So it falls upon us to figure out how to keep the world going in a more accepting and pluralistic mode. Yes, sir.
The issue of young women leaving the church and not following into the Relief Society has been raised, and Bob talked about missionary work and how we send young people into the world. But it seems to me that one of the important implications of what you're talking about has to do with our missionary force. Because we have had a very important coming-of-age experience that affects many of the young men. The number used to be 50,000 in the church. I don't know where it is now. 50,000 are going out to convert people to our church between the ages of 19 and 21. And what you're saying is that that generation is going to be less and less interested in conversion and more interested in pluralism. Mm-hmm. Would you like to make any comments?
I see where you're going, but I note also I said that the Mormon tradition registers much lower on those trends than is true for other religious traditions. It seems to me that probably Mormonism will continue to have a pretty good record on inspiring that kind of service, even as the millennial generation reaches those ages, and soon will be. But in principle, I think what I was saying would apply to most religions that engage in that kind of activity. Mormonism is such an exception. So that makes it far more difficult to predict just how that will go. I would not expect huge decline in that pattern in the next 10 years. So that's just my off the cuff thought on it. I don't know.
I have a question about the Pew Religious Survey. Mm-hmm. I have seen, but not firsthand, that the survey states that for the first time ever, the LDS Church has a retention rate of less than 100%. That for every 4 converts we get, 5 people are leaving the church. Would you know if this is true?
I don't know if that's true. I checked the general patterns for the various faith communities, including Mormons, but I didn't zero in on that particular indicator.
Okay.
So
even in my own observation, I personally, in the last 3 years, know more people who are left than I know who have been baptized.
Well, I can't comment on that. I don't know either the baptismal statistics or the rate of leaving. But I can say that the level of what we sociologists call religious switching from one faith tradition to another is relatively high in our society. Statistics suggest it's rather around 20-22% of people do switch out of the faith tradition in which they were raised into some other kind of tradition. And about 5-6% of people are like perpetual switchers. They never stay in one place. They keep the journey is better than the destination, so they keep going. So there's a fair amount of religious switching. So certainly that's true with Mormons as it is with others. But again, I suspect it's less for the reasons I've outlined earlier, that the Mormon tradition seems to hold its members to a greater degree than the other faith traditions.
You mentioned that agnosticism is growing, whereas atheism is not. I have seen some news stories about atheism growing among those between 18 and 25, and that overall Americans, they're getting a little more aggressive with the atheist books in the past year, and now Bill Maher making this movie. So do you see anything in the surveys indicating atheism growing or becoming more aggressive?
Well, that's a good question, and you're absolutely right. There are two things going on here. Remember, the surveys are these broad pictures with huge numbers of people. I just mentioned a few surveys, 37,000 people. That's different from trends in books. Now, it is the case that there's been, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there have been a lot of books that have come out about atheism, or and you can come up with some titles. Sam Harris had a book.
Christopher Hitchens.
And there have been a lot of others. So there's been a kind of popular currency of that, in particularly among many young people reading books of that kind, questioning religious faith. But when you look at the surveys, that just doesn't register in any big way. Atheism, if 92% of the people still say they believe in God, and again, I qualified what that could possibly mean and what kind of God, but if 92% say yes, it hasn't been much higher than that in any period that I'm aware of. We've only had polls and surveys for about 75 years or so. We don't know what that was like in earlier times, but it hasn't changed that much. So there hasn't been much room in there for something called atheism. But it has become more popular to talk about atheism. And I think that feeds into perhaps greater agnosticism than real, genuine atheism. Well, I have kids in my classroom all the time talking about I'm an atheist. And, I think it's kind of popular to do that. But is it real atheism? Probably, by and large, not. A lot of people who are not sure have questions. People are upfront with their doubts today. It's okay to share your doubts, partly because of these popular TV programs that encourage you to let it all hang out. So that's just part of their contemporary culture. But I would call that more agnosticism than outright atheism in the classical sense of the meaning of that word.
Over the last 2 years, we've seen an enormous increase in the Hispanic population of the United States, partly by birth, partly by immigrants, legal and otherwise. It seems to me that most of those people come from a fairly conservative Catholic background and end up in a United States that is quite a bit more liberal than the sort of developing world that they come from. What kind of fallout do you see from that kind of cultural collision in religious terms?
Well, you set up the problem correctly that the Latino population, Hispanic population in this country is rapidly growing. It is the largest so-called minority population in the country. One thing that's happening is that the face of Roman Catholicism in this country is rapidly changing. It's becoming Latinized. It's losing much of its so-called Irish historical background style to a more folk-oriented, family-oriented style of Catholicism that characterizes Latin American countries, Central American countries. So the face of Catholicism is undergoing a rapid change. Secondly, we've got some of the same trends beginning to happen with Latino populations that have been happening for a longer time with Euro-American traditions. That is, switching religions, often dropping out, still answering pollsters and sociologists like me if you ask them, do you have a religion? Yes, they're American to say. Still saying that, but no, I don't go to church, if they're truthful. So they will get that. So a lot of Latinos now beginning to accommodate those same cultural patterns that Euro-Americans have been into for a long time. So there's important changes going on for the Catholic tradition, and at the same time, kind of Americanized patterns that are becoming evident among Latinos. So we don't have time to go into the political aspect of this, but you've got an interesting combination of kind of a liberal political stance combined still with holding on to a relatively conservative or traditional religious culture. And that in itself is a fascinating combination.
It seems to me that I read statistics that say people in Europe are much less religious or have much lower beliefs in God than in the United States. I mean, the United States is so high, and Europe is so low, and culturally we're so much the same. How do you account for that?
Well, that's a big question, too. There's no simple answer to that question. European societies have been so-called secularized to a far greater degree, or in a way that's quite different than Americans have been secularized. Patterns of secularization are the removal of religious influence from the society. In European society, historically, it occurred along a different trajectory than is true in this country. It would take us a long time, a whole seminar, to go into that. But in a nutshell, religion has been shifted to the periphery of the culture, more so in European countries. To the periphery. Small, church-oriented populations. Most people identifying less as religious, more in secular terms. In this country, by contrast, if you want to use the word secularization, it's the religious content that becomes secularized, and not the fact that people leave religion, so to speak. They just begin thinking, well, I can decide for myself how to think about this. I can choose to think of God in my own way of thinking of God. So in one sense, the boundaries between religion and the rest of society are stricter in the European context, and people either stay with the traditional way or they have to leave. There's no middle ground. In our system, our religious traditions have been far more accommodating to those internal changes. So that, I think, helps in part to explain the differences in these trajectories. I see a sociologist or religion.
I was just going to say we'll take our question from our resident sociologist here, Harlan Moss, and then I think we better move on to our closing exercises.
Are you here to disagree with me on what I said?
I think I might be able to say a few helpful things in response to some of the questions that came up a few minutes ago about dropouts and so on in the LDS case.
We don't know. Armand has studied the Mormon tradition, LDS tradition, for many, many years, decades, and he's an authority on this tradition. So please, so correct me where I'm.
I'm not inclined to offer any corrections, but there are a couple of things I might say by way of some expansion that would be helpful in response to some of the questions about the Mormon case in particular. You have such a broad knowledge about the religious scene generally, and mine is more in-depth about the Mormon case in particular, so we have a kind of complementary situation there. On the Pew survey, I haven't either, any more than an earlier speaker did, looked at the data themselves. But I would be very surprised and would tend to doubt that the Pew data show a figure comparable to what was cited, namely that for every four Mormons that are recruited or baptized, that five leave.
Mm-hmm. Just in North America.
Well, even in North America. The situation is complicated in this way. First of all, it is important to specify if you're talking about North America or not. The dropout situation is far more grave for the church outside of North America, actually, than it is in North America. Unlike the United States, a lot of other countries allow questions in their census about religious identification, which we don't normally do in our census. And so from the census data in other countries, we're able to compare what people report to their census takers about their religious identity with what the church records show in that same country about religious identity. And the discrepancy ranges from about 25 to 35%, which is to say, only about 25 to 35% of the people who are reported as church members by church records in other countries will themselves identify themselves as church members when the census takers come. And that's on the basis of about half a dozen countries from which we have been able to get census data. David Knowlton has done work on that, and so has Rick Phillips. And those have been published for some time now. And outside of North America, another thing that's kind of grave about the dropout rate is that when they drop out, it's much harder to get them back than it is in North America. In North America, there's actually a dynamic process. It isn't absent in the other countries, but it's much more important in this country. Namely, that you can't study the dropout situation in North America as long as you take a snapshot of a moment in time. To really understand it, you have to study the life cycle. And over the life cycle, you have a certain percentage of people who drop out of the church and come back. Some of them drop out for 5 years at a time, maybe three or four times in their lifetimes, and then come back. And the most authoritative picture on that I've seen is actually now getting a little old. It's 1992. It's in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, the Vital Statistics section. Tim Heaton from BYU laid out a diagram that kind of showed this process and what percentage of Latter-day Saints drop out and never come back, what percentage drop out and come back, and what percentage never drop out or never don't circulate at all, but stay either in or out, you know, after a certain point in time. So it's a dynamic process, and it's a little difficult to answer for North America the question of what the dropout rate is. But one check is, attendance at sacrament meeting or worship service, which runs around between 40 and 60%, depending on the part of the country.
You're talking about Mormons?
Yeah, Mormons. And the church's own official definition of what's an active member is somebody that comes to one worship service a month. So you've got to also then have a definition in mind of what's an active member. So unaccustomed as I am to brevity, I hope you'll forgive my going on about this, but that might help clear up some of the questions that were floating around. Oh, one more thing. I did a historical study once that showed that the dispersion of missionaries in the church and of the missionary leaders to a variety of foreign countries from the middle of the 20th century on played a major role in the change within the church of its race policy. And so I think that on that particular point, at least, the influence of the missionary program could be demonstrated. Thanks for letting me have the time.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.